Okay, well,
let's see what's
friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they face the vaccine spot. Oh, bye, but I'm sorry, like I say that. Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please.
Are you ready
for this?
The cameraman said, what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular hit.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that this ain't like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, indeed, these are strange days, indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of the strangeness. Welcome to those of you listening here in Canada, on the web, via the live stream, and to you listening wherever you are, via the newly established podcasts. Welcome to program number 391. Tonight, Stanton T. Friedman and Frank Fascino Jr. discuss UFO shootdowns. Alfred Lemberg takes us home, but tonight here in studio, and he'll be here later also with his take on it, is Dave Ferlott, my co-host Victor Vigiani.
Good evening.
Hello. Gentlemen, I don't know whether you got a chance to read this morning on the UFO updates list at virtuallystrange.net. This came in from Gary Anthony to the updates email list this morning. Dear colleagues, for many years we've endeavored to discover the precise roles, policies, and actions of the Ministry of Defense in the United Kingdom concerning UFO phenomena. This focus has been directed from various perspectives and most recently utilizing the new UK government's Freedom of Information Act. The information that we've uncovered reveals a hitherto unknown and far-reaching aspect of the MOD's involvement in the study of UFOs. Newly discovered documentation supports and validates the research and conclusions of serious UFO researchers, whilst highlighting several concerns the Ministry of Defense have about the potential within the UFO phenomena. Hello.
Mm-hmm.
The information has already been released to us, that's the group that got this stuff together, in its entirety by the MOD and will shortly be available to the general public. We expect a great deal of media interest and so advise paying close attention to the UK press and television news sources, beginning with the BBC tomorrow night in the UK, so in the afternoon for us here. For further information, please visit uk-ufo.org from Monday, May the 8th on. It's going to be interesting to see what comes out of that and see if the media around the world picks up on it.
That's the big key.
And also out of the UK this week, the BBC Click program, which is actually a computer program dealing with the latest in the computer technology and news, interviewed Gary McKinnon, who was arrested by the UK's National High-Tech Crime Unit after being accused of hacking into NASA and US military computer networks, looking for UFO-related material. An interesting interview. It's available on video, online. You can go to tonight's program listing, and in the news and info, there's a link directly to the video. But here's a couple of moments from that BBC interview.
I was using something a bit like PC Anywhere, called Remotely Anywhere, so I could actually see the desktop of the machine I had control of. And if you were walking past there, you would see the mouse move and me doing whatever I was doing on that desktop. I was in search of suppressed technology, referred to as UFO technology. I think it's the biggest kept secret in the world because of its comic value. I assumed that although it's part of a secret government project, there must be military ties. I'd read 400 expert witness testimonies, ranging from civilian air traffic controllers through military radar operators, all the way up to guys that were in charge of whether or not to launch nuclear missiles. So it's a very credible people. all of these people had said there are UFOs, there are aliens. One of these people was a NASA photographic expert, and she said that in Building 8 of Johnson Space Center, they regularly airbrushed out images of UFOs from the high-res satellite imaging. And using the same technique, I got down to Building 8, got a few machines there, and what she said was there was there. There was folders called filtered and unfiltered, or processed and raw, something like that. I got one picture out of the folder, bearing in mind this is a 56K dial-up days, a 235 megabyte picture, and if you're talking 5 minutes a megabyte, obviously impossible to download. Also in a NASA proprietary image format, not a GIF or a JPEG or anything. And bear in mind, you're not downloading it, you're viewing it remotely. So in a way it is downloading, because the picture's coming from there to yours, but you're not downloading it as a named file to your hard drive, you're viewing it through an application. So using the remote control program, I turned the color down to 4-bit color, the screen resolution really, really low, and even then this picture was still, you know, juddering and coming onto the screen. But what came onto the screen was amazing. It was a culmination of all my efforts. It was a picture of something that definitely wasn't man-made. It was above the Earth's hemisphere, kind of looked like a satellite. It was cigar-shaped. It had geodesic domes above, below, to the left, to the right, and both ends of. And although it was a low-resolution picture, it was very close up. This thing was hanging in space. The Earth's hemisphere was visible below it. And no rivets, no seams, none of the stuff associated with normal man-made manufacturing. This woman had said, this is what happens in this building, in this space center. I went into that building, that space center, and saw exactly that. And I'm sitting there, bedazzled, you know, thinking, crikey, this really is looking weird and weird, the more that comes of it. I didn't think I'd be caught 3/4 of the way through of looking at the first picture I'd looked at. And also, I was amazed that it was how she said it would be.
Gary McKinnon, who, if he gets extradited to the United States this coming week, faces 60 years in jail. But it's the first time we've heard him talk about what it was that he found on the NASA computers anyway. And he was talking about the 400 witnesses. He was talking about the Disclosure Project witnesses.
All of the airbrushing that goes on before they
release it. And we played that very woman's clip from the Disclosure Project on this program. And maybe if we have time, although I doubt it tonight, we'll get into it and play an excerpt from that.
These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
There's an upcoming conference in Toronto on Tuesday, May 9th, called Exopolitics Toronto Press Conference, and will feature Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project, along with the Honorable Paul Hillier, former Minister of Defense for Canada. The conference will present a press screening of authentic military, corporate, and government witness testimony that will present compelling evidence attesting to the reality of an extraterrestrial presence and the 58-year-old military government cover-up of this issue. At least that's what we hope shall happen. However, on a personal note, I have a few issues, mostly concerning the learned Dr. Stephen Greer as the man heading up the Disclosure Project. You see, I believe very strongly that we need disclosure from the government. However, I also feel that ufology cannot afford the luxury of thinking that the end justifies the means. Having Dr. Greer as the head of the disclosure effort is akin to putting the mentally challenged in charge of the asylum. Dr. Greer has a very checkered past within ufology because some of his claims of what he has experienced are of a nature that defies believability, and furthermore, can neither be proved or disproved. In other words, there's no provenance. Among some of the charges leveled by UFOWatchdog.com are reportedly plagiarizing work of other ufologists to sell as his own, selling do-it-yourself contact ET kits that allow you to vector in a UFO with your own personal little flashlight. Now, one of my personal favorite claims that Dr. Greer makes is that U.S. military forces attacked an extraterrestrial base in a mountain in Colorado with nerve gas. But, of course, once again, there exists nothing to prove that this event ever happened. And finally, the claim that UFOWatchdog.com says is that Dr. Greer had dinner with the director of the CIA. Of course, Dr. Greer claims that he personally briefed the CIA director about UFOs for several hours. Finally, UFOWatchdog.com documents that Dr. Greer attempted to charge Washington State MUFON members $2,500 each to demonstrate how he can vector in UFOs. Greer got to choose the location and the time, of course. But all of this pales when we take in the disclosure press conference that Dr. Greer headed up on May 9, 2001 at the Press Club in Washington, D.C., in a bid to push for the congressional hearing about UFOs and aliens. Now, initially, the press conference looked like a really good thing, because many witnesses who had previous ties with the military, the government, and government-associated industry came forward to give their testimony about what they had witnessed and experienced. But, and I knew you knew there was a but, unfortunately, some of the witnesses that Dr. Greer chose to bring forth should not have been there, because other ufologists had already shown that some of those witnesses were less than credible. Now, the problem in disclosure is that every last person who is willing to testify in front of a congressional hearing or some other government body like the Senate needs to be vetted so that everything that they claim can legitimately be backed up as fact. For example, if someone claims that they are or were a commissioned officer in the U.S. military, there better be a paper trail to show it and not a paper trail that shows they were nothing more than a non-commissioned officer. Ufology witnesses are like apples. When you have a bushel of apples, all it takes is one bad one to contaminate the others in the bushel. If we are ever to get Congress, the Senate, the House of Commons, or any other government body to listen to us and to help us find an answer to what is the truth behind ufology, we are going to have to provide them with someone that is more tangible than a bunch of people giving testimony about things they've done or experienced mixed in with other people simply trying to pass off some fictionalized tale as their own experience. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
Yeah, I'm amazed that Dr. Greer is still doing what he's doing. I suppose one can say in his favor that he's doggedly doing it still, despite all the criticism.
He is definitely going after it. There's no question about that. The problem is there's so much in his past that he needs to basically get rid of right off the bat. And once we get by that, then it's a situation of saying, okay, these are the people. These are the people, their references check out, their background checks out, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. These are the people that we're going to put forward that says, this is what they've seen, this is what they've done. If their background checks out, that's just the right step. If their background falls flat on its face,
yeah,
all of a sudden anything that they could be saying is questionable.
And it's not going to stand up in any sort of commission of inquiry into UFOs.
No.
And the minute the researchers for the commission, wherever they be, either side of the border, the minute they find questionable credentials, then the whole thing goes out of the window, and you've only got one shot at it.
They throw everything out.
No matter which side of the border.
That's right. As soon as they find one person involved in that group at all that is questionable in any way, they throw the whole thing out.
Exactly.
All of a sudden, UFOs, ufology, everything is, it's a joke. And it's not a joke.
No,
it's
it
serious.
Isn't. It's serious
very
stuff.
Serious.
And it's a pity to run the risk of getting everything thrown out, throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Exactly. We can't take the chance. We've been trying for years now, for years, decades, actually. We've been trying for decades to get somebody in government to listen to us, to come forth and actually take a point where they can say, let's do something with this. We can't take the chance that once they do that, once they come forward, that we're going to blow it. All the T's have got to be crossed, all the I's have got to be dotted, and it's got to be 100%.
It's, you know, the whole thing with the Disclosure Project and the exopolitics is not going to make it.
I don't care how we do it. We have to separate disclosure from exopolitics as far as we can, because the two of them are not interchangeable. One of them doesn't have any, as I said, any provenance, and you're trying to mix that up with disclosure, which is something real and tangible.
A man who has become very much a part of the UFO culture is Stanton T. Friedman. We know that Stan has done all kinds of amazing work over the years on the Roswell case, and Stan is a firm believer in MJ-12, and Stan has teamed up with Frank Fascino Jr., and Frank has done the most astounding investigation into the Flatwoods Monster case. They've been collaborating of late, and joining us on the line are both Stanton T. Friedman and Frank Fascino Jr. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
You have both been digging around. I guess it goes back, what, to the early 1950s, and it sounds like something out of a B-movie somewhere.
Come on.
Yeah, I mean, War of the Worlds of late, and certainly Star Wars, but dogfights going on between UFOs and United States Air Force planes?
Navy yeah. planes as well, and Marine Corps planes as well.
Really?
And yeah, what we seem to have stumbled on, partly because people didn't like the use of the term dogfights in the promo for Frank's book first time around, was that 1952, everybody knows who's interested in UFOs, that was the big year for UFO sightings. Project Blue Book had its highest number by far of cases. There was a huge press conference in July in Washington after sightings over Washington, D.C. That's all old news. But what we discovered, because people didn't think that there were dogfights, is we gathered in all the goodies, got people like Dr. David Rudiak and Barry Greenwood to gather in what they had. And what we found was, amazingly enough, that there was a whole culture, military culture, in 1952 that said, let's shoot down flying saucers if we can. And so we found many articles saying that it was direct orders from the Air Force. Pilots were ordered to shoot down UFOs if they don't land when instructed to do so. Now, I could just think a whole bunch of cartoons with that motif, you know, the pilot pointing to the ground and the UFO guy thumbing his nose at him or whatever.
Yes, flipping in the bird.
Yeah, and the thing is that we found so many articles, and what amazed me, because I've been so involved with Roswell, was here was another role for General Roger Ramey, who was head of the 8th Air Force in 1947. He was only a brigadier general then. But in 52, he was with their defense command, and he was a major general. And there's an article in which he is quoted as saying, we have scrambled, sent interceptors up hundreds of times. Now, he didn't say a few, he didn't say several, he didn't say many, he said hundreds of times.
Hundreds.
Yeah, right, Frank? You've
yeah,
got
that,
it there.
That was actually quoted in a newspaper July 30th, 1952. And I'll give you the exact quote here, be on the record correct here. Major General Roger Ramey, Deputy Chief of the Air Force Staff for Operations, told the news conference that interceptor planes have raced aloft several hundred times as a result of reported sightings of unidentified objects. Now, here's the great part, Stan. He said that was just standard procedure. The news conference they're talking about is the big press conference that took place at the Pentagon just right before.
Hundreds of times is kind of a big statement, and that was not in a major newspaper, was it, Frank?
It was in the Louisville Courier Journal.
Well, it is a major newspaper, but it certainly wasn't in the New York Times or the Washington Post or, you know,
right.
Most of us have read before about 1952.
Okay, this was July of 52?
July 30th is the date of the article.
Right.
So the Air Force would have been flying, like, Sabre jets or something like that. So
well,
they would have actually been jet aircraft scrambled,
Sabre jets.
Too.
Yes, Sabre jets and Starfires, basically.
And one of the things that we discovered is when you started looking more carefully at this, if you step back and say, okay, you're a Soviet military person and you're an alien. Both of you would want to know what the capabilities are of the defenders of the United States,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't you?
Oh, for sure.
It may be in one case to overcome them when you drop a bomb, and there was, young people may not realize this, but there was very serious concern in 1952 when we were tied up in Korea that the Russians were going to attack. Their atom bomb program had been moving forward very rapidly. There was a memo with the National Security Council that I saw. It had been declassified like 1951 or so, that the Russians had made more progress in the development of nuclear weapons and methods for delivering them in the past 18 months than had been expected for 5 years. There was honestly the thought that when Stalin had enough airplanes, he would come and attack, because the U.S. was tied up in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
He had trusted Hitler. That didn't do him any good. The Cold War was moving in a very hot direction, and the Chinese were helping out the Koreans much more than the Russians were. So that left us vulnerable. So my point is that they would want to know our latest radar equipment, our latest fighter capability, our latest armaments capability, air defense kind of thing. And Frank found out that the F-94C was now using a new weapon.
They had, what they actually had was the 2.75-inch Mighty Mouse rocket. And they were actually put onto the Starfire C stand, and they were unveiled on July 2nd, 1952. And there's a small little quote in Edward Ruppelt's book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, where at least one of the scrambles on the second weekend of the Washington, D.C. sightings, which our listeners are probably familiar with that story a million times, but one of them was an F-94C. And so they were chasing these UFOs with rockets, not just the standard bullets that were on the previous jets. And by the way, the F-86D Sabre jet was also carrying rockets at that point.
They were actually using rockets at near the end of World War II as well on the Typhoons. The interesting thing as well is Strategic Air Command and Russia in 52 were still, they were all playing the games of seeing, testing each other's defenses, seeing how close they could get in before they,
and
the defenders were scrambled.
Don't forget that in 2001, the U.S. government had a huge conference to which they invited the relatives, families of the 166 American military people who had been in reconnaissance planes that never came back.
The reconnaissance planes where? Across
near,
over the pole?
No. Near the Soviet Union, near China, and near North Korea. This is before we had spy satellites. And so these planes, sometimes they may have wandered across the border, not intentionally, of course. And we, of course, shot down a few Russian planes, but both sides kept this completely secret. Families were lied to, because you see, the bottom line of what Frank and I have been talking about is that apparently planes disappeared.
106 aircraft basically disappeared.
The key thing here is that one of the things I had said that stirred things up at the time of Frank's original book coming out was that I had heard a half a dozen accounts of more planes going up after UFOs than came back. And I was challenged, where's your signed, sworn statements and, you know, the tapes and, you know, everything? And I said, look, these guys talked to me after my lectures or privately. There was no opportunity to get this kind of information, and they were risking everything. They needed to tell somebody I was there. They'd heard me speak. They felt they could trust me. But when I hear independent accounts telling basically the same story, two went up, one came back, that sort of thing, after the first half dozen times you say it was probably happening. I've heard a couple more accounts since. And if I've heard that many accounts, think how many must have happened. And one of the things Frank took note of in great detail was that there were loads of airplanes, jet interceptors, that crashed, disappeared, disintegrated. And Frank, what'd you find? Three guys who had over 100 missions in Korea?
Yeah, three different guys, Stan. And actually, I started my research back in going back to 51.
Yeah.
And the first outstanding fighter pilot was 12th ranking ace, Captain Donald Gentile. He had 182 combat missions. He was killed on a routine flight in a crash of a T-33 jet over Maryland.
Routine training flight, wasn't
yeah.
it, Frank?
That pops up probably about 90% of the time, Stan. And the cause of the crash was not immediately determined. And what's interesting about this, Stanton, is this fella here, Captain Gentile, he won 14 bravery awards, and President Roosevelt called him Captain Courageous in the one-man Air Force. And during World War II, his nickname was the Messerschmitt Killer. And there's just loads and pages of guys who just disappeared and were killed.
Without any MiGs chasing them on the eastern part of the United States. So, you know, that does raise questions, but it makes sense if the policy was try to shoot them down and the aliens didn't happen to like that, and especially if we used radar on occasion and radar lock-ons and they saw what was happening, they might have said, hey, guys, enough is enough. And one of the stories that got me going many years ago was from a radar operator in Kalispell, Montana. They had a call from Canada about a UFO heading their way. They had a jet in the air. It was already in the air. And they vectored him in the direction that the UFO was going. They watched all this on radar. And no more airplane. The UFO took off at very high speed. They knew exactly the altitude, the speed, the direction of the R-jet, and never found wreckage, never anything. The interesting thing to me was the guy who told me this story, quietly, nobody else around, said that after that, the word went out, don't shoot, take pictures. And so what Frank and I also found is that the accident accounts are missing in many of these things. I was at the National Archives, we looked through the files, they're missing cases. Frank got started because two pilots was actually on the day of the Flatwoods incident.
Yeah, about approximately an hour before the ship touched down in Flatwoods, there was an F-94 jet that disappeared off the face of the earth. Never been found to this day, Stan, in shallow waters.
Incidentally, the accident report there was loaded with, how shall I put this, idiosyncrasies, bad answers, things that didn't make any sense. Frank had some experienced Air Force people look at one of these and a copy of that, and it didn't make sense. Somebody was lying.
Something that really caught my attention when we were looking into this was actually Captain Edward Ruppelt's statement about the lore of duels of death that's stated in his book.
Duels of death?
Yes, because it's right in his book, and it seems it's been overlooked.
I overlooked it.
Yeah, Ruppelt actually says, other assorted historians point out that normally the UFOs are peaceful. Gorman and Mantell just got too inquisitive. They just weren't ready to be observed closely. If the Air Force hadn't slapped down the security lid, these writers might not have reached this conclusion. There have been other and more lurid duels of death. Now, that's a quote from Edward Ruppelt in his 1956 book.
Wow.
And he was a conservative kind of guy.
Yeah. Very much so. And the two cases he's talking about is Captain Mantell, who died while chasing a UFO near Franklin, Kentucky, and Gorman was an F-51 pilot with the North Dakota Air National Guard. He was involved in a dogfight with a UFO.
Maybe our audience is a little confused about numbers, because we had talked about, 161 reconnaissance pilots being lost, mostly over, Russia and China.
Yeah, those weren't in fighter planes now. Those were in big multi-engine planes. Probing the Soviet Union, you know, that sort of thing.
So do we have a count on the fighters that were lost over U.S.
airspace?
Well,
we know how many. Frank, what would you say? There were more than 100 crashes, weren't there?
Just from what I found in the New York Times, Stanton, there was about 130 between 1951 and 1954.
Wow.
And 95% of those were over the continental United States. These were jets that didn't crash in Megali or, you know, didn't fight in the Russians. This is over on stateside.
Do we know whether most of those were experienced pilots or were some of them trainees?
There was a mix, but I'll give you an idea of a couple of the guys that I've been researching right here. 1952, this guy had 100 combat missions. Another guy, Navy Cross Commendation Ribbon. These different guys have all types of medals. Here's another guy completed 105 combat missions in Korea, earned a Distinguishing Flying Cross and Air Medal with 3 outclasses and 13 months in the Far East duty. He came back to the United States, and he was killed mysteriously. You know, here's another guy, veteran of 100 combat missions in Korea. He shot down 2 MiGs, 1 Tu-2, and damaged 2 MiGs. He received the Air Medal and the Korean Service Medal. The cause of the crash had not been determined. The list just go on and on and on. These guys were experienced pilots, missing pilots. Here's another one from 1954. I brought this all the way up to 1956. And the list just goes on and on and on.
And the thing here is that we don't know what happened to these guys, but we do know with the stories that I've heard as a background, and with General Ramey's comment in the foreground of this whole period of time.
Hundreds of aircraft being scrambled to go check out UFOs.
Yeah, and if you don't think they're a threat to the security of the country, why do you scramble jets who you've ordered to shoot them down? It makes no sense. And one of the reasons for being on tonight is I'm hoping we can convince some people who are still in law alive and who know about such cases. You know, maybe they were working on the line. Maybe they had pilot buddies who went up and didn't come back. Maybe they were listening. I had an article in UFO Magazine asking to hear, and I just got one yesterday about a pilot who was at a base where he was in the control tower when they were chasing UFOs, and there was a sound of a crash over the radio of some kind, and one pilot was gone. So I would love to hear from any of these people. I'll give out my email address is FSPHYS, Flying Saucer Physicist, that stands for, of course, at rogers.com. And my mailing address for anybody who would like to drop me a line or a clipping or tell me to talk to somebody else, and I don't use witness names without permission, my mailing address is Post Office Box 958, Houlton, H-O-U-L-T-O-N, Maine, M-E, 04730-0958. And in Canada, and presumably these are mostly Americans, but who knows who lives where anymore, in Canada it's 79 Pembroke Crescent, Fredericton, New Brunswick, E3B2V, as in Victor, 1. And my toll-free number is 877-457-0232. And we're looking for information, and we'll follow up on any leads we get. We'll let you know, Errol. And incidentally, I must compliment the your interest group. Holy cow, that article about Susan Clancy's book.
My interest group, UFO Updates email list, and compliments to you on an interesting review, and I want to say an excellent review, but it's not really an excellent review as far as Susan Clancy's concerned. Those of you who haven't come across Susan Clancy's book, it's really not worth reading.
Yeah, that's also posted on my website at
StantonFriedman.com.
StantonFriedman.com. And what surprised me, Earl, is I got a lot of offline comments from people who wanted to reprint it. Could they use it in their place and so forth? A lot of people watching your interest group.
Reading the archive of the UFO Updates email list.
Just an email list?
It's just an email list.
That doesn't sound good enough for it, Errol.
Thank you, Stan.
Let me tell you a quick story from somebody who survived one of these incidents, a Navy pilot who was scrambled, went up, was vectored in, spotted a light below him. It came right up toward him, ahead of him, bright light coming at him. He squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened because the guns hadn't been loaded by the mechanics. He was interrogated for several hours thereafter.
Oh, my.
I talked to that man. He's still flying airplanes. He's in his 70s, and he's a practicing attorney. We agreed that he was probably still alive only because...
the guns didn't go. SDI at virtuallystrange.net if you want to get hold of either of our guests. Do we have any hard and fast numbers where we can point to certain reports and say, there, that's definitely something that happened to an aircraft while it was chasing a UFO?
Not numbers. I don't think we do. And certainly the government has not issued any reports, unclassified ones anyway, as far as we know, in which they say, oh, look what happened to that poor pilot. He got zapped by an alien. Too bad.
Mm.
Wouldn't that be neat? But we don't have any such stories. Although, you know, the role of the government in all this is, you know, I always talk about Cosmic Watergate, but Frank put together a video which he showed at the Aztec UFO conference in late March, in which he interviewed, he's the only one who has, Colonel Dale Leavitt, who was heavily involved in the Flatwoods incident. He was sent to Flatwoods on orders from on high. Frank, why don't you tell what he told you?
Well, actually, Colonel Leavitt told me that he received a call in the middle of the night from Washington, D.C., and the Air Force had told him to get together all of his troops and go to two different target zones to investigate two particular incidents that occurred.
In West Virginia in 1952.
Right. This is on September 12th, the night of the Flatwoods incident. One of his missions was actually go to the Flatwoods farm where the incident occurred, and the other one was about 15, 16 miles away. It was a sighting of an alleged plane crash. And Leavitt got together 180 troops, and he brought them down the Elk River into the area of Duck Creek. Half of the town had seen this thing hit the side of a mountain, and it proceeded to go up, and it landed somewhere on the top of this mountain. Well, they never found anything there. They were there for most of the night. Leavitt then went up to Flatwoods and cordoned off the farm, and he had about 60 troops who stayed there the night.
They gathered up goodies and sent them off, and nobody heard from those goodies since.
That's right.
And Frank is the only one who he ever spoke to. Leavitt was pretty tight-lipped. This was the National Guard we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
He was also, what, a sheriff, Frank?
Yeah, he was the sheriff in the early 60s. He was a well-liked guy, but he was a hard-nosed guy as well, as I found out. He was not too easy to work with.
What I'm saying is, here we have an instance where Frank has direct testimony, and he didn't live too many years after that. He certainly hadn't talked to anybody else.
No.
But here was a retired colonel who admits that they picked up pieces which they sent off, that they were called, went up there in secret, did their thing, were convinced something strange had happened. They never said anything.
He was told by the Air Force to stay there the night. His troops, they stayed there overnight in case something else happened. That's a quote.
So National Guardsmen recovered whatever went down there in the side of the mountain, put it on a truck, and it was...
No, the little pieces of stuff. They didn't have the actual craft. You know, the equivalent of footprints and fingerprints and...
Pieces of the stuff, broken shrapnels, pieces of the grass and area where the different films and sediments had rested on after the craft had landed there.
And what did he think it was that he and his men had recovered?
Well, they didn't recover a craft.
No, they'd recovered debris, wreckage.
Debris, exactly.
So what did they feel that it was that they had picked up and sent off?
They had no idea. But Leavitt told me personally he didn't believe whatever it was that had landed there came from here.
Mm.
From Earth, that is.
From
here.
Including Canada.
And the first target zone they went to down the river with the initial 180 troops where this thing crashed, it was seen by townspeople. It was right along the river, along the Elk River, where the main road follows the river through Rackson County. And all these people saw this thing hit the side of a mountain, lifted up, and it landed up on the top. When all the troops went down there, and by the way, Stanton, the sheriff's department also went down there, and they didn't find anything. It was had taken off, and it was gone already. And that's when Leavitt was told to go to the target zone area number 2, which was the Bailey Fisher Farm, and cordon off the area and stay there the night in case something else happened.
Well, Frank also talked, I should add, to Stewart. Mr. Stewart was the, what would we call him, the big shot reporter in the area, the publisher?
Yeah, at Braxton County in 1952, Stan, there was only one automobile and one television, and the Stewart family owned both of them. They owned the big newspaper business.
Yeah, they. What I'm saying is Frank got an interview with him, and this was in this video that was shown at the Aztec conference. Frank went to film school, so it isn't exactly an amateur production. What I'm saying here is that there was a lot going on, that the government was well aware that something strange was happening. Frank's book and the new version, the new edition, should be out before the end of the year. There were a lot of problems with the first edition because, well, it's a long story, which I won't go into, but the publisher did a lot of things he wasn't supposed to do and left out a lot of things he shouldn't have left out. And so there were people who were complaining about the book. They had some legitimacy to their complaints. But
the good thing is that now you're able to put all of these shoot-down reports and interesting stories into the new book. Gentlemen, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. It would just be so much easier if the government released the reports of downed aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Now, real quick before we jump off the line, we were talking tonight about the Air Force's stance on the shoot 'em down orders. In 1956, that order was reiterated again on July 19th. And an interesting part of Stanton telling the Navy story, on July 26th of 1956, it was publicly made this quote by Navy, shoot to kill if saucers are encountered. And what that actually involved was a command that was issued to the pilots of the Trans-Pacific Hop in the Hawaii region. And that was the orders, quote, shoot to kill. So we don't just have the Air Force, we have the Navy involved in this as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess with the Braxton County and the National Guard going in there, the suggestion is that there was some sort of altercation between a UFO and a fighter plane. Is that where we're going with that one?
Yeah.
Right, and I actually, through my research, Errol, I found out that there was 18 and a half hours of sightings. This wasn't one little isolated incident.
Ah, you see, now that's an important detail in all of this. When the book is about to come out, let's have you back and we'll talk about this some more.
Good.
Frank Fascino, thank you, sir, and Stanton T. Friedman, thank you, and look forward to talking to you both again real soon.
Thanks for having me on.
Good night, gentlemen.
Good night.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
It's amazing, some of this stuff.
Isn't it?
Wow.
And who knew about all of this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, we had an idea. We sort of thought that perhaps Mantell had been shot down, but now it turns out there are hundreds of chases. Strange incidents of aircraft going out with experienced pilots and not coming back. And not only not coming back, but the wreckage not being found.
Well, the other thing, too, is with them going after it and shooting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And an email here from Brian Boldman. I'm a big fan of your show. Never miss it. Reed Greer, Dave was right on with his take. I've had personal experience with Greer in Gulf Breeze, Florida, during the Walters Flap in 91. Greer held a training course at the Gulf Breeze Holiday, and it was really nothing but a New Age brainwash. Later that evening, all the inductees met at a Pensacola beach to vector in UFOs with high candle power lights. Greer claimed there was a mothership in Earth orbit. His claims are and have been grandiose. Brian Boldman, who, by the way, will be speaking at the Denver MUFON UFO Symposium about angel hair. Angel hair, kind of like spider web.
Yeah,
Of it very sort of gossamery and silky. That stick falls from the sky and sticks to things called angel hair. A lot of UFO sightings above where the angel hair has fallen in the past.
They haven't been able to actually get enough of it to sort of analyze it or anything. It's amazing stuff.
Well, most of it, when it's exposed to air, just dissolves. But Ted Phillips says he has some in a jar that hasn't.
Oh, I missed that. I want to see that.
Go to iTunes and download the podcast of last week's program. And good to have all you podcast listeners along for the ride. Program 392 of Strange Days Indeed. Every second week on this program, just like Dave Furlot is a regular weekly contributor, often on the phone from home, but tonight in studio, Alfred Lemberg joins us from his Sweet Home in Alabama. Hello, Alfred Lemberg.
I had this little thing that I was going to do at the beginning, you know, where I was going to, like, drop into a radio voice and try for a little comedy. And then I heard Mr. Friedman and Mr. Fascino drop the most astounding report, and I knew about it. A report that has Stanton Friedman jumping up and down, and I think that's kind of difficult to do anymore, you know?
Yes. Boy. We're not just talking years either here, are we?
No. Stateside flying crashes where, look, I was a military aviator for 23 years. I know that if you're having problems with pilots and aircraft in peacetime, everything stops, is grounded until you stop. Well, at the bottom line, quit wasting all that money. You know what I'm saying? So those people were up there doing something real, testified to by numerous high-ranking officers, that I feel kind of a kinship with some of these pilots that went up on some of these missions where they're going toe-to-toe with the freaking aliens. And I regret and I'm enraged by the discredit that some of them have gotten, as is testified to and documented and backed up, I think, pretty much by Frank Fascino and his book there. I was gut slammed again, and I know the story, you know, pretty much. I mean, like I say, it's an astounding report. It's a smoking gun. Gee, I guess UFOs aren't really all that dead after all.
Yeah. Only in the opinions of writers, reporters who really haven't done too much checking and just take the word of frustrated reporting agency people who are not with the times and with the program and do not understand the intricacies of the web and how easy it is to go to a website after you found it on Google to report a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't want to write out enormous long forms anymore, whether it be from MUFON or Bufora or any of those organizations who did good work in their time. But now it's been taken over by the likes of Peter Davenport and Brian Veich et al. You know, it's all being done online. And an email here from Brian Boldman. I'm a big fan of your show. Never miss it. Reed Greer, Dave was right on with his take. I've had personal experience with Greer in Gulf Breeze, Florida, during the Walters flap in 91. Greer held a training course at the Gulf Breeze Holiday Inn that was really nothing but a New Age brainwash. Later that evening, all the inductees met at a Pensacola beach to vector in UFOs with high candle power lights. Greer claimed there was a mothership in Earth orbit. His claims are and have been grandiose. Brian Boldman, who, by the way, will be speaking at the Denver MUFON UFO Symposium about angel hair. Angel hair, kind of like spider web.
Yeah,
most
strange.
Of it very sort of gossamery and silky, that stick falls from the sky and sticks to things called angel hair. A lot of UFO sightings above where the angel hair has fallen in the past.
They haven't been able to actually get enough of it to sort of analyze it or anything. It's amazing stuff.
Well, most of it, when it's exposed to air, just dissolves. But Ted Phillips says he has some in a jar that hasn't.
Oh, I missed that.
Oh, you missed
that. I want to see that. Oh.
Go to iTunes and download the podcast of last week's program. And good to have all you podcast listeners along for the ride. Program 392 of Strange Days Indeed. Every second week on this program, just like Dave Furlott is a regular weekly contributor, often on the phone from home, but tonight in studio, Alfred Lemberg joins us from his sweet home in Alabama. Hello, Alfred Lemberg.
I had this little thing that I was going to do at the beginning, you know, where I was going to, like, drop into a radio voice and try for a little comedy, and then I heard Mr. Friedman and Mr. Fascino dropped the most astounding report, and I knew about it, and recomposed and recompiled a report that has Stanton Friedman jumping up and down, and I think that's kind of difficult to do anymore, you know?
Yes. Boy. We're not just talking years either here, are we?
No. Stateside flying crashes where, look, I was a military aviator for 23 years. I know that if you're having problems with pilots and aircraft in peacetime, everything stops is grounded until you stop, well, at the bottom line, quit wasting all that money. You know what I'm saying? So those people were up there doing something real, testified to by numerous high-ranking officers, that I feel kind of a kinship with some of these pilots that went up on some of these missions where they're going toe-to-toe with the freaking aliens. And I regret and I'm enraged by the discredit that some of them have gotten, as is testified to and documented and backed up, I think, pretty much by Frank Fascino and his book there. I was gut slammed again, and I know the story, you know, pretty much. I mean, like I say, it's an astounding report. It's a smoking gun. Gee, I guess UFOs aren't really all that dead after all.
Yeah. Only in the opinions of writers, reporters who really haven't done too much checking and just take the word of frustrated reporting agency people who are not with the times and with the program and do not understand the intricacies of the web and how easy it is to go to a website after you found it on Google to report a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't want to write out enormous long forms anymore, whether it be from MUFON or BUFORA or any of those organizations who did good work in their time. But now it's been taken over by the likes of Peter Davenport and Brian Veich, et al. You know, it's all being done online. Want to let those people know who are listening via podcast to this program that if you go to virtuallystrange.net and click either Strange Days Indeed or UFO Updates, you will learn more than you ever thought you could possibly learn about this subject.
And those of you listening to the podcast are indeed listening to a podcast.
Thank you, Alfred.
For clearing that up for us. Now, something that's interesting, by the way, Alfred.
Yep,
when you consider that the official word is that UFOs pose no threat to national security, yet the U.S. is scrambling jets to shoot down UFOs, huh?
Well, I think we always knew that it was bupkis from the very beginning when they're flying down to nuclear sites and turning them on and shutting them off at their will. You know, that's a pretty big breach on national security, too, I would think. That
well,
flying alongside dummy warheads off the California coast and firing blue beams at them.
And the better part of it is, of course they pose no threat to national security because we can't do anything about them.
that's a big problem right there, yeah.
Hmm.
With regard to Mr. McKinnon in England, though.
Oh, yes.
I think that's extremely interesting, and whoever is in England needs to really look out for this guy and keep him over there, tried by whatever laws they have over there, because I'm really concerned about the guy's safety if they get him back over
there. Oh, yes. He was first told by the security police when they first busted him back in 2002 that he'd probably get 6 months of community service. You need to go and look at the full-length interview, not the show that it was edited down for, which is a computer program out of the BBC, but they nicely put up the whole interview with him, and that's worth going and taking a boo at.
Well, it's pretty obvious that they embarrassed a lot of security people who are supposed to be interested in keeping security. It was so incompetently handled and amateurish and second rate.
Yes.
That, you know, I mean,
that's one of the joys of not putting in an administrator's password in Windows. And that's how he managed to get into those computers. But what's fascinating is hearing the disclosure witness, the woman, say that this was going on at NASA. And then McKinnon following it up in 2002 and going to the very building and finding the evidence of the fact that there was tampering on NASA images.
Stan Friedman did mention something about lies, did he not? I really don't think, you know, you have to put more of a point on it than that.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we move on?
But of course.
The Honorable Paul Hellyer. Okay, now, whatever you might think about the Honorable Paul Hellyer, I mean, the fact is he's called honorable, and I think the evidence is, or could certainly be argued convincingly, that he's not past it intellectually. as an octogenarian,
mm-hmm.
that he's not a knowing liar. Where is the evidence for, you know, that kind of behavior in the past? I'm not Canadian. Is there any?
No, of course not. He may have been misled and uninformed and seriously uninformed.
Yeah.
What a book to choose to come out and base your beliefs of the fact that UFOs are real on the book that he did, Philip Corso's The Day After Roswell.
Well, he just didn't know about Richard Hull.
No, he didn't. Or Richard Dolan, or Jerome Clark, or Stanton Friedman, or
Kevin Randall.
Et Sigal.
Yes. You know, that's too bad. And Mike Woods and I were sitting in the Disclosure Symposium back in September of last year, sort of leant forward a little bit with anticipation as Mr. Hellyer started out. And then he got to his epiphany, the great revelation was, you know, the Philip Corso book. And we both looked at each other and slumped back in our seats and said, oh.
Yeah, just unfortunately, the wrong reading material.
The guy must have completely no imagination and his basket case intellectually, just a completely credulous fool. you see where I'm going with this is that he is not. He sees something beyond the pale there that we really should all be investigating, and
decidedly
are not.
No.
Even Paul Kimball and I agree to a point regarding some of his associations. Dr. Greer, for instance.
Yeah, and there we really do need to leave it. We have about 25 seconds left to bail.
Oh, well.
Thank you, Alfred Lemberg. Thanks, Stan Friedman. Thank you, Frank Fascino, Dave Ferlott, Julian McNabb here in Toronto, and Jim Pacheco in Montreal. That's tonight's program. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Neff.